or Mr. Sirangelo, would you like to tell us about your childhood before you moved to Harford County?
Yes. I was born in Italy, a town between Naples and Cosenza in 1912. My father came to America 4 or 5 years before that period of time, and he was traveling for the Italian newspaper. Somewhere around 1910, he was covering a few articles on the East Coast and found himself in Jacksonville, Florida. At that point, he met my mother. My mother was the daughter of the monk of Abruzzi, who gave up monkhood to marry and came to the United States. My mother was born in Philadelphia. Needless to say, my father was born in Italy. I was born in Italy after my father deciding to marry my mother and decided to take a 14-month honeymoon trip abroad. The result of that was that I was 3 months old when I came to America. Sometime around the middle of 1913, having been born February the 20th, 1912. Our stay in Jacksonville, Florida was short. I spent most of my life prior to coming to the proving ground, to the Ballistic Research Laboratory, in the Philadelphia suburban area. I was educated in the Philadelphia schools. Upon entering my adult life, I was employed by the auto car company, and I was shop engineer. I was shop engineer for 6 years prior to coming to the Ballistic Research Laboratories in Aberdeen in 1942. From that point on, I decided that I wanted to make Maryland my home. And in 1946, decided to purchase a piece of ground, which was then called Gover's Hill on the Star Route, which is 155. Upon the purchase of that piece of ground, I decided to build our home. I spent 2.5 years doing that, starting the exact time of 10 o'clock February the 22nd, 1947. At that time, we dug our foundation. I spent 2.5 years building our home. doing 75% of the work myself, and June the 7th, 1949, we entered our new home. At that time, the traffic was not pronounced on Route 155. At this moment, it surely is. My life in Harford County has been a most enjoyable one. Above all, having spent 33 years in the ballistic research lab and retiring, I have taken many treasures in my life, such as those lovable avocational activities that you pick up through life. One of those is winemaking. I have enjoyed winemaking to a very great degree. I have a 1,500 to a 2,000 bottle wine cellar, which I thoroughly enjoy, and a vintage cellar that is within range of 15 years. I also enjoy lapidary art. I love to cut and fracture a stone that may have centuries of silence speaking to you. The beauty and formation of rocks the world over is a beautiful thing to envision. I thoroughly enjoy lapidary work and have cut stones from all over the world. I also enjoy silversmithing. I do some of that with some of the semi-precious stones that I form and cut and shape. I have also enjoyed Harford County with its vegetation and its green growth, and I have tried to add to that green growth somewhat of the beauty of my garden. I also enjoy horticultural activities. I have taught some courses at the Harford Community College. I also speak to garden clubs on the growth, preparation, and cultivation of roses. I also have a dahlia garden and a hibiscus garden. The dahlia garden is one that is, I believe, a garden all by itself. The plants can be seen at about a height of 10 to 11 feet, and the blooms are within range of prize-winning dahlias of somewhere between 10 and 13 inches in diameter. And the displays of dahlias, roses, and hibiscus are something to behold. Do we want to cut, or do you want?
That's quite all right.
Do you want me to continue with something else?
Okay. Back to your childhood. Would you like to tell us about what you used to do in your free time or your social life?
In my free time and social life, I studied music I studied voice and violin for about 6 years. I gave up on the violin after that period of time. Like all young boys, I loved football, and that took precedence. But I continued voice. I continued voice for a total time frame of about 10 years. And at one time, I was thinking of continuing my singing, but decided not to. As a result, I spent 40 years with church work. I spent about 22 years with the Grace Methodist Church in Aberdeen, doing choir work with them.
About your schooling, could you tell us some of the schools you attended and some of the courses that you have learned?
Most of my education was in, all of my education was in the Philadelphia area. I studied 2 years after high school, I studied 2 years of diesel engineering. I studied 2 years of architecture with the M.J. Reiser School. And I studied for 2 years with the Emily Kreider Norris School of Dramatic Art and Elocution. That was the same school that trained Edward Everett Horton, John Beale, Ann Harding, and Libby Reynolds. The school was directed by Emily Kreider Norris, and the Plays and Players Theater, where the performances were cast, 1714 Delancey Street, was directed by Jasper Dieter, one of our most and greatest directors in amateur theaters. Again, he was responsible for Ann Harding, Alexander, Edward Everett Horton, John Beale, and,
You were talking about your career with your time with a semi-professional theater and the different actors and actresses that you knew there.
Mm-hmm. I have always enjoyed the theater. Upon coming to the Proving Ground, I decided to form a dramatic group. And in 1943, I formed the Proving Ground Dramatic Club. I was the director for 3 years. Upon giving that responsibility up, the Dramatic Club was continued as later known as the Showboat. The entire company just shifted into the Showboat, and we were launched in Havre de Grace. I believe it was an old tugboat. Within 3 or 4 years of that time frame, the company again changed its name and went into the Susquehanna Players. Again, as time went on, the Susquehanna Players went into the Edwin Booth Theater. Here again, as time marched, the Edwin Booth Theater entered the present Phoenix Players. That is the historical review of the beginning and end, as of the moment, of the drama group. Again, the very beginning, the Abilene Proving Ground Drama Club, and as the status quo of the moment, the Phoenix Players. Although the Edwin Booth Theater is still an entity.
While you're the director, can you talk about some of your duties and responsibilities that you have for the drama club?
Well, in the very beginning, we had very little talent to choose from, and we did not have a home, that is, a home to cast whatever play or plays we were thinking of doing. And the first play that was ever put on by the Abilene Proving Ground Dramatic Club was put on at the elementary school on Route 40 in Aberdeen in 1943. Because of the nature of the building and the classes that were held and the demands on the entire school structure, we could only work in the evening, and the set had to be finished the evening before the opening night, which was a very difficult and hard, difficult thing to do. It was done, but starting the night before, or the afternoon before, at 3:30, going through the entire night until 5:30 that morning, and then casting or putting on your play that evening, that was the kind of time you had. And if you could not have put the play on in that short a time frame, you would have had to forego it. So the props, the stage entries, all had to be done and rehearsed all on the final evening before the play went on, before the curtain rose. They were wonderful days, and I can see where today's pattern of casting and doing little theater work would certainly be somewhat different from that which it was in 1943. I retired in 1973. At that point, I wanted to raise peacocks. I chose to do so, and presently have 9 peacocks. Well, I should say peafowl, 4 of which are peacocks. The others are peahen, or hens. I have a beautiful flock of white kingbirds. They're majestically snow white. And they're wonderful pets to have. And they roam between the back of the house and the loft. I have always, going back to music, I have always enjoyed music. In 1974, I believe, or 73, I was asked to become part of the board of the Hartford Opera Theater. At that point, I was one of its directors. In 1977, after having had quite a difficult time keeping up with finances, I was asked to become its president. I was president of the Hartford Opera Theater for close to 3 years. About the beginning of 1980, we were coming into Chapter 11, and within a short time frame, we had gone bankrupt. That was a most unfortunate happening, because there was a wonderful evening to enjoy. While the Hartford Opera Theater was operating. But like all classical music, it needs a little more help than rock and roll. Financial help. The demise of the Hartford Opera Theater left a hole in the musical world of Hartford County. That is yet to be filled.
Well, can you tell us about some of the things you did with the Hartford Opera Theater?
Yes. Such operas as Trovatore, La Bohème, Carmen, Marriage of Figaro, Golly, I'm having trouble recalling a few. Maybe I should
look for
some of the brochures.
I guess returning back towards your earlier days, when you first moved to Hartford County, what were some of the differences that you noticed between Hartford County and your former hometown, such as in Jacksonville and the Philadelphia suburbs?
Some of the differences that were noticeable upon leaving the suburban Philadelphia area was a slower pace, a little different attitude of life, something that was of a slower pace, you had time to think of things that you wanted to do yourself rather than to a greater degree with others. I thought that was an asset. I can go on back to the point when I was building our home. And upon leaving the office, I would find myself right here, which is now the home, start working the moment I got here and work until midnight almost every night with electric light. And your activity was centered around the building of the home. Upon getting in, of course, then your social life took on something more normal. But the differences were that you felt like you were in the open to a greater degree than psychologically within the constriction and confinement of many, many, many more people. You certainly had more time to meditate.
You also mentioned that there is a difference in attitude between the Philadelphia suburbs and Harford County. Could you explain that for us, please?
Well, there's a slower pace of life within Harford County. And of course, there is a difference in Harford County now in that the social life has advanced to a greater degree than that which was present in 1942-43. The arts have come on into the county. The arts have filled somewhat of a gap that was there in 42, and the various companies, talent companies, that have come on in to Harford County have done nothing but to enrich the county. And the inhabitants, or those Harford Countyans, have taken well to the educational levels that have presented themselves in the county, such as the development of Harford Community College and other educational standards that have advanced. Harford County has grown considerably since my entry into it.
When you started work for the Aberdeen Proving Grounds as their design chief engineering design draftsman,
yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about what that work entailed and some of your duties and responsibilities?
Well, as chief of the Aberdeen Proving Ground, or the Ballistic Research Lab drafting and engineering design section, We worked on many projects, and it could be part of a helicopter wing, or it could be a phase of a building. It could be a plan that someone could have had on a systems analysis, and they would have wanted that documented on paper. And relaying their rough patterns to the drafting section, we would finalize them into the final stages for production or fabrication.
Are you talking about the many different graphs in with
There were many graphs on theories and statistical information and studies that were all part of our operation.
Or could you tell us about some of the problems and successes that you've had during all that planning and some of the things that have gone right or have gone wrong?
Well, I think being responsible for the final product in a finished manner of drawing is a responsibility, and you've got to make sure that once it goes to press, once it goes to the shop, once it enters the final stages for reproduction or whatever that may be, that it's as flawless as it can be. And that would be the thought that you would have to carry for your entire stay in that particular job.
Or could you tell us some of your duties that you had other than designing different parts for weapons?
No, I did not have very many other duties. I did have a duty that I considered important, and that was that of a mediator. I think, if I recall, we would have to go back to somewhere around 1960, and it had to be with equal opportunity. And it had to do with upper mobility. And I was the BRR representative for that phase of operation on the grounds. DMPS had their representative, and other installations had theirs, and I was representing BRL.
Or what type of things would you mediate between when you represented BRL?
Well, for instance, discrimination. If you had four or five people coming to work together for a few years, that association created a partiality that would oftentimes exist within the closeness of four or five people coming to work together, as against someone on the outside of that group. By that I mean, let's assume that a person was being considered for a position, a higher grade, by virtue of being in that group of five. In a few instances, there were expressions of partiality by considering those that were closely knit together as against a person that was on the outside of that group. I have at least two conditions such as that, where I mediated that. It's particularly brought to mind by a group that came across the bay. And there was an individual on the other side of the fence that thought he had been bypassed. We corrected that problem, and it took about 6 to 8 months to do so.
Well, you also mentioned that you did work for the Grace United Methodist Church. Can you describe some of the work that you've done there?
Well, I formed the Grace Methodist Men I believe that was 1955. I became its first president. As of last year, there seems to, there seems to be a pattern that wants to repeat itself. And it appears as though the Grace Methodist Men would like to revitalize themselves into having a new start. The present Grace Methodist Church in Aberdeen is the advanced structure of the old church on the same site. And going back to 55 or 56, when I was president of the Methodist Men, after forming it the previous year, it was the original church.
As president of the Grace Methodist Men, what were some of your responsibilities for that group?
Well, we put on summer we had at least two summer picnics, and this was a little bit for fundraising too. We would have three or four ice cream festivals, and we made our own ice cream, and as much as 55 gallons in one evening. And they were wonderful evenings of entertainment. We would start selling ice cream at about 6:30 to 7 o'clock, and by 12 o'clock we were still functioning. We don't do that anymore, but they were most enjoyable evenings.
What were some of the activities besides fundraising did you do with the Grace Methodist Men? Would you present concerts or classes?
No, it leaned more towards a spiritual class. I'm not sure what the meaning would be at this moment. Time certainly marches on.
Or could you tell us about some of your work that you've done for the Salvation Army?
I was with the Salvation Army on the board of directors for 17 years. I was president for two. The Salvation Army was a very fine organization. It was needed in Harford County to a very great degree. It was needed to a greater degree in 1965 and 66 and 70 than it is today. I think there's a slightly different economic level in today's world than that which existed in 1965.
During that time of need in the middle of '60s, what were some of the things you would do to raise, I guess, food supplies or blood drives or things? What were some of the things you did during that time for the Salvation Army?
Well, when I first came into the Salvation Army, I was asked to come on in and I was partially responsible for starting our present building. Up to that point, or prior to that point, we were meeting in a very, very small hole in the wall on Washington Street. Upon my being invited into the Salvation Army, within a month we had taken the thought and the ball, and we were running with it. And it was but a few weeks after that we started building our present building. I believe as of now, that building may not be large enough, but there is ample space for an addition.
What type of work then also did you do besides playing the building for the Salvation Army? Did you help construct it?
No. The function of the board was to recommend. The function of the board was to recommend thought patterns. And all Salvation Army centers do not operate with a board. But Heaven and Grace did have a board of directors. And I thought it was very good.
Or Or can you tell me maybe some of the other responsibilities that the board had besides just making...
Well, they'd be broken up into committees. You would have one person being delegated the responsibility of suggesting conditions that were occurring, such as building repair, there was one thing that I noted, that oftentimes the operation of the Habit of Grace Salvation Army would change with the new commander, with the new captain, or the new lieutenant. Like everything else, every person has a personality and his own viewpoints, and has his idea on how things should be done. So, the new man being assigned to the Habit of Grace area would have a thought pattern that was his, and naturally, he would like to express it and have it implemented by whatever board thinking. In agreement.
Or can you tell us about some of your work with the Veterans Hospital?
Oh, yes. I was on the Veterans Board for 3 years. That was very interesting, because you had time to express a layman's point of view on the medical practices there. And it was the responsibility of the layman appointed to the board to, above all, consider patients' rights. That was a very good committee. And above all, it had a tendency to keep a medic on his toes, because the medicine practiced had to be part of the patient's point of acceptability, and the patient being aware of what he is taking or being administered. The doctors that were working, or are still are working at the hospital, upon administering medication or treatment to anyone interned at the VA hospital, certainly keep in mind the patient's freedom, and the patient being given the privilege of accepting or denying treatment. If there's a question, the patient certainly had the freedom to say, that he did not want to accept whatever the treatment or medication may have been. So the administration worked both from the side of the medic, working for the patient, but the patient was fully aware of the type of treatment that he was going to receive.
Very good.
So that was, I thought that was a good system. And I thought that was a very good committee.
For about the different events of Haverty Grace, maybe you could tell us about some of the businesses or maybe the politics that you've seen or different things like that. Just about Haverty Grace in particular. Maybe some of the mayors, like I remember Mayor Mackley, or some of the councilmen, about some of the things they were doing or helping the community, or maybe some of their darker sides.
Well, I would like to put it more broadly. In my years in Haverty Grace, or 41 years in Haverty Grace and 4 in Aberdeen, I would certainly say that Haverty Grace has grown from a very small community, always a little lovely town, but politically a very small community, into one that has developed into a little city that can hold its own. It has a beautiful waterfront. It has some lovely streets. It has some lovely homes. And above all, there are some people that are really working for the restoration of some of the old homes in Haverty Grace that really helps make it a lovely town.
Remember anything about the racetrack that used to be in Haverty Grace?
No. I have never have I gone to that track. I think it was there until 1949. And I never had a feel of wanting to get near it, because it was a rather rugged part of town at the time.
Over the years as living in Harford County, what are some of the changes that you've noticed, either in the people's attitude, the way of life, or this maybe industry?
I think the way of life is pronounced in that industries have come on in and economically Haverty Grace is much better off, and when you change the income pattern of any community, you help change its life, its attitudes, its mannerisms. You cannot keep an element on the same level once you change the economic level, it will always find its own cultural stability. It will always go towards the things it wants, because it can afford it. And by virtue of affording it, you automatically change a society. You change society by virtue of altering its economic levels, because that's the very thing that refines those that wish to be refined into other phases of life. Economics and the economy of any one given community has an unusual bearing on the community. You have those that know how to handle it and go on to achievement, and you have those that have the same opportunity but can't handle it and don't go anywhere. So there's a pattern in life, I believe, that says the soldiers that can't walk die along the path of life. Yes. And I think this happens all the time.
Or would you like to tell us about your lapidome hobby, how you got started, and where you find these precious stones?
Yes. In fact, I'm going to show you a few stones while I talk about them, if you would like.
Oh, that'd be quite nice.
Now, here is a stone from Africa, and it's called malachite. And it's a beautiful green. Now, that has a high density. It's high in iron, and you can't work on it for any prolonged period of time, because it has it's a very toxic stone, and while working on it, in breathing in the small particles of water or dust, it can very easily kill you, because in breathing it in, the toxicity of it will destroy your kidneys and liver. Now, feel the weight of that.
It's quite heavy.
Very heavy, and again, strong in iron. Now, that is taken out of the bogs of northern Africa. And the finest malachite in the world comes from northern Africa and Russia. Now, you can see where this is a collection of twigs and small branches. And because it's not of a solid mass and it's a collection of particles, you notice that there's a greater beauty in the finished pattern. Now, that is not a completed stone for mounting, but the face is finished. Can you see the configuration of that, how beautiful that is?
Oh, that's quite nice.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Well, you see, here's a stratified piece, but from one mass. And you notice that the configuration within the stone will vary.
This is almost a strata pattern, layered, while that is just a pileup of anything that fell into the bog. Now, here's another very beautiful stone. It needs polishing. I haven't polished it for a while. But this is Mexican fire opal. Take a look at the reflection of that. And that is a very lovely fire opal from Mexico.
It's quite nice.
Now, here's one. Oh, I just finished this about 2 years ago. Now, this stone is one stone, and I polished it and cut it in half, and this is Botswana, from about the center of Africa. Now, that's Italian coral. Excuse me. Now, this is a composition, as I mentioned, of Botswana, Italian coral, and again, Botswana, that has turned into a very pretty composition.
It's quite beautiful.
Isn't that a beautiful thing?
Yes.